Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots non-profit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on kx935.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Friendship Show here on KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. Sitting in for The Importance of Being, we're going to do a two-hour show this morning. Joining us in the studio right now is the Executive Director of South County Outreach, Laura Fisher, is here this morning. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks for getting up so early.
I drove in from Laguna Niguel, so it was an easy drive, but the beach, even though it's cloudy, was completely full already this morning.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Where in Laguna Niguel do you live? Because I live on the Dana Point, Laguna Niguel border there.
I live on really the kind of Laguna Beach. I live kind of in the Crown Valley, Alicia type area.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time on Crown Valley.
Yeah, well, it doesn't everybody, right? Like, that's a pretty slow commute these days across there.
Yeah, it is. Well, a few weeks ago, we don't get bogged down in local talk here, but a few weeks ago, Crown Valley was completely tore up.
Yeah.
You were driving down, it was like driving down a dirt road. I mean, there's got to be a better system here.
You would think, right? But it's getting better, and it's the gateway to the community there, so it's exciting stuff.
Yes, it is. It's the gateway to the community over there. South County Outreach is the organization that you don't work for them. You're the executive director. You run the show over there.
Well, I'm not sure I run the show. I think the people working for me run the show, but I have the title. So,
what does South County Outreach do exactly? What's the focus of the organization?
We are a hunger and homelessness provider. We were founded 26 years ago by a local businessman in Laguna Hills, who at that time saw a need in South Orange County where a lot of other people didn't. And he really started with a hunger focus. And at that time, it was a one-day-a-week kind of food cupboard that people were able to come and get food and additional funding. And we've since grown to a very small but mighty $3 million nonprofit. We are actually on Watney in Irvine, between Lake Forest and Bake. So we have really quick, easy access for people. We used to be in Lake Forest. We've moved around a little bit, but now we've got a really great home. We moved about 2 years ago into that space, and the good news was we moved from Lake Forest, and we loved Lake Forest, but we doubled our space, but our rent remained the same. So it was a win-win for everybody.
You gotta like that.
Right? Now we are operating a five-day-a-week food pantry, and with that, we will assist about 3,000 folks a month. We've got 5 industrial refrigerators and 4 industrial freezers, so we're able to provide produce and dairy, and proteins, which is a really big deal, because when you think about food pantries, so much of what is on the shelves is exactly what your doctor tells you not to eat. So we have a real focus on nutritional food, and educating people about that. Not really telling them what they need to eat, but making sure that they've got enough information and enough options. We even have a gluten-free section.
Come on.
Oh, yeah, gluten-free. And we have pet food, because, when so many people are facing hard times, they don't want to get rid of that extra member of their family. So we've got a lot of people that donate animal food to us as well.
3,000 people a month. You have like more than 100 people a day, because you're open 5 days a week?
We're open 5 days a week.
Monday through Friday?
Yes.
How does it work? Do people just show up and they go shopping? Or
they do. We use a program called Client Choice, so it's very much like going to the grocery store. The folks that visit us have the opportunity to pick what they want. I think anybody that's had a 5-year-old in the home knows that if they're not going to eat green beans, they're not eating green beans. And, peanut butter is one of the only real non-perishable proteins, but a lot of kids today are allergic to peanut butter. So it used to be when you'd visit a food pantry, you'd get a prepackaged box or bag of food that was just given to you, here you go. One, I don't think there's any dignity or decency to, hey, I'm going to pick out your food because you're having a hard time financially paying for it. So we've got volunteers that assist them. I'm unbelievably lucky that I have 250 volunteers that show up every week and work a shift for me.
Come on,
I typically
really?
Knock on wood when I say that, because without them, we could never do what we do. And they apologize when they go on vacation. But if you arrive at our doors at Monday at, you know, 8:30, you would every Monday, you would see the same beautiful people there volunteering every week, each week, unless they were on vacation. So we're very lucky. So the folks that visit our pantry go through with a volunteer and are able to pick the amount of food and the choices of food that they want. Sometimes that's very healthy, sometimes not. For people that have visited a food pantry, we talk about pounds all the time, because that's really how we work with the IRS, is everything is weighed in and weighed out. So traditionally, a family of four will receive about 100 pounds of food for a week. We know that's not going to feed them for the entire month, but it's able to get them through and keep them bridged. We see families visiting the food pantry about four times a year. We know that when you come to our doors, no matter whether you're facing hunger or homelessness, you know, this isn't a happy day for you. So there's a, we try to, the walls are painted kind of like they are in here, very bright colors. You know, we try to have a smile on our face, and we try to have people leave there in a better place than they were. But it can be still be very humbling, even after, you know, the financial challenges that I think everybody understands much better now than they used to. It's still a very humbling place for people to come and ask for help.
I think, you know, Margie Wakem was here a few weeks ago, and she was talking about sort of the different struggles, the specific struggles that families face. And that's one of the things that she talked about, is that it's difficult for a mother or a mm-hmm. father, or a mother and a father, to bring their children to a place like that and say, I need help providing for my family. That there's, you know, it's a very humble place to find yourself.
It really is. My office is right off kind of our main lobby, and I can still hear when a man, especially a man, visits for the very first time, mm-hmm. because there will be a nervous laughter associated with, well, you know, what do you do here? How can I help? You know, a lot of times it's, well, I've come to volunteer, and after talking to them a little bit, we understand that in addition to wanting to volunteer, they probably need some services as well. So, you know, the good news with volunteers that have time during the week is a lot of them have a lot of life experience, meaning age. And, you know, your grandma can ask you questions and say things and tell you that it's probably going to be better than your peer can.
Don't you find that, though? And I think that, you know, sort of speaks to the, you know, the character of the people who use these services, is that someone comes in and they need something from you, but they want to do something in exchange for it. They want to pay for it however they can.
Yeah.
And if that means standing behind the counter and helping someone else, they want that opportunity to give back.
You know, we track the people that are coming through our doors, not because we want to turn them away, but we want to know where they're coming from. We want to know how often we see them. We want to know what other needs they may have. And what we have found since I've been there is that about 70% of the people that are visiting us for food assistance are employed. They just can't afford to live here. So that's a very difficult thing, too, I think. You know, when we're back to the humbling situation, is you're working full-time or trying to work full-time, and no matter what you do, you still can't afford to house or feed your family.
Right. You do more than a food pantry, though. Much
more,
don't you?
So we also have a homeless prevention program. So we are able to, we've got about $100,000 that we spend each year assisting people from becoming homelessness. So once a year, they're able to come in and kind of go through a process with us. And if they're facing eviction, we're able to pay their rent to keep them housed. So I think that's one of the toughest jobs in our building, because due to the limited funding, there's an awful lot of no's that have to be told to really good people. The numbers there, we've seen a real increase. When I got there, we saw about 5% seniors. Now we're up to almost 10% seniors.
Wow.
And, you know, last week we had an 80-year-old woman that needed help paying her rent. No local family. All of her family was on the East Coast, and I'm not sure that her family knew kind of the challenges that she was facing. It's very hard, you know. I mean, with younger people, you can talk about, depending on what their challenges are, increasing income, you know, reducing some of your expenses, those types of things. But when you're 80, it's not like I can say, hey, I'd really like you to go get a second job at Walmart to help you pay your bills.
Right.
So, you know, that can be a pretty sad day for the team running that. And then we have a workforce development program. We have a computer learning lab that's sponsored by Toshiba and Cox. And we're able to assist people with increasing their computer skills. And in surveying that group, something really interesting came to light. 15% of the people that were in our classes this summer had master's degrees. Any idea why you think that is?
No, what?
They were all over 55. People over 55 are making high salaries, so they're easy to outsource when you need to make a change. The other challenging thing is people over 55 typically have an assistant. So they have folks that are doing things for them, right? So it's been a long time since you've worked in Excel or you've worked in PowerPoint because you had people do those things for you. So we had a gentleman with a CPA degree that went through and was going to open his own business and really just kind of wanted to refresh some things. So we're very proud of that program. Works, again, 5 days a week and in the evening. And it's the Microsoft Suite and then Access and QuickBooks. Access will be rolling out this fall. It used to be, again, word processing could get you kind of an entry-level job. Now people want you to have a little bit of accounting and a little bit, you know, of database work as well. So that's a good program. And then we do have a housing program. We've got a couple of housing programs we're working. We've recently rolled out a rapid rehousing program, which was completely new to us, though there were several agencies in the community that were doing that. We own 17 units in South Orange County. They're beautiful condos. Most of them are next to the pool, very similar to the condo I lived in and before we bought our house. So they're beautiful properties. You would never know that there was a homeless family living next to you. In the past, for about the past 15 years, we had used those for transitional housing. We're doing some different things. We still are running a small transitional housing program for families. But we're also partnering with other agencies to use some of those for rapid rehousing as well.
So when you say you've switched some of that transitional housing over to rapid rehousing, and for people who are involved or understand the talk, that means that you're putting people into those apartments and they can stay there for as long as they choose to and are able to pay the rent and those sorts of things.
So our transitional housing program was really kind of a 6 to 9 month program, very templated, if you will, and they work for some of our, especially some of our single moms that have come in that maybe, you know, recently we had a woman come in that had gone through a really, really bad divorce and needed some additional time. And she was really looking for people to support her more on a regular basis. And for some of our clients, that works. But from a rapid rehousing standpoint, yeah, the clients immediately go into a unit that will become theirs, and there's no expectation that they will move out. There's still support services for them, but it's not on a, okay, this is the plan we're going to follow, and we think this may work for you. It's more tailored to what your needs and your family's needs or the individual needs may be. So some people need counseling, some people don't. Some people are looking for some budgeting help, some people don't. You know, what we found when I first joined the agency, you know, our goal was really on savings, and we would have folks that could leave transitional housing with anywhere between $3,500 and even $7,500. Go ahead.
Well, I've been there, done that.
Yeah.
Right? And here's the problem with that. And it's great for people to have that. I wish I had that much in savings.
Me too.
The problem is what you were talking about before is that you can have $10,000 in savings. The minute you move out of our, you know, helpful
our
subsidized program,
yep.
you're bleeding cash.
Yep.
Because you can't work enough hours to sustain this.
You bet.
And so it might last 6 months, might last a year, might last 2 years, but at some point it's paycheck to paycheck again.
Yeah.
And if a paycheck is missing, it's a catastrophe.
Yeah, it really is. You know, and one of the things we're seeing more of now that is even a bigger catastrophe is unbelievable debt. So, you know, we're seeing homeless families come in now with anywhere between $30,000 and $50,000 worth of debt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think all of us can, that's insurmountable to be able to cut that down. So, you know, we work with those families more with crediting and what can they do. You know, I read an article recently that talked about that now an eviction is the stigma associated with an eviction is very similar to having a criminal record. And, you know, families, whether it's rapid rehousing or any bridge housing, any form of housing, being able to help families get past what the average landlord, the average employer sees as a stigma is what we need to be focused on.
Yeah. If you have an eviction on your record in Southern Orange County in this housing market, you're at the very bottom of the list.
A landlord doesn't have to take a risk on you because there's three or four people standing in line behind you that don't have that.
Absolutely.
And that's just true countywide,
yep,
in terms of both the price of housing as,
yep,
well as the availability. It's very hard for these families that don't have a perfect record, whether
right,
it's the debt or the evictions, to get in even in through the front door.
Yeah.
I just renegotiated my lease. I'm a renter. And I lost horribly. And really what it came down to, and I have a great relationship and I love the community that I live in the people that I work with, but my rent went up considerably.
Right.
And I said, is this negotiable? Can we talk about this? And they said, Mark, you know, we'd love to, but here's the deal. If you tell me you don't want to pay this amount for this apartment, I will post an ad this morning and someone will take this apartment without having ever seen it. Right. And that's just the reality of the situation.
You know, I think one of the other challenges that folks are facing when they're renting is the bundling of services anymore. So, you know, in the past, it was very much you had your own meter and you paid for your electric and you paid for your water and that was fine. Well, now in a lot of the larger communities, they're bundling all of the services. So you pay for the water in the pool. You pay for the water, you know, the electricity that's running all the lights in the parking lot. You know, we had a woman come in who had an unbelievably high electric bill, and, you know, we were talking to her about what's running in your household. And when we looked at it, you know, she's like, well, I'm only taking a shower once a week because my water bill is so high. And, you know, I looked at her and I said, oh, dear, it doesn't matter. You can take a shower every day. It's not going to make any difference.
Yeah, they repaved the sidewalks in my place the last couple of weeks, and that's, I just walk by it and go, I wonder how much that's costing me.
Exactly. And, you know, when you're saving every cent to pay just your general bills, anything like that can cause you to lose your housing in Orange County.
When the Rapid Rehousing Program that you run, what's the commitment that you have in terms of time with that family? Are you moving people into the unit and then are you backing away? Or are you with them for a month, 2 months?
We can be with them up to a year is what kind of our commitment is. Yes.
Financially?
Well, not so much financially, but from a services standpoint. Okay. And really the evaluation from a financial standpoint is when we're budgeting, we look at that could be part of the commitment. Ideally, that's not, and we haven't had somebody that's needed 12 months at this point. In most instances, it's about a three-month commitment to get them where they're feeling pretty stable and comfortable with what they're doing.
And that means, for people who are listening, that means that for 3 months, you're willing to pay part of the rent so that they can get caught up or get that extra job or move up in their employment, whatever they're working on.
Correct.
And then after that 3 months, then you start to back away financially. Mm-hmm. They take over the apartment on their own.
Yes.
So who qualifies for that program currently?
You know, our programs, our founder was very much committed to families, similar to Families Forward. So when Margie was in here, our programs run very similar. And we're right down the street, which I love because are similar. We can complement one another. So we're focused on families. We don't really determine necessarily what family is, except that there needs to be minor children in the home. Mm-hmm. So we've had two-parent families, we've had single-parent families, and we've even had grandparents raising grandkids in that program. We like them to be employable, but they don't have to necessarily be employed. And they need to be literally homeless, which means, you know, they can't be couch surfing. They need to be living in a car, a bus stop, or, you know, a place that's not meant for people to live. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of the focus. Again, it's small. We've got 4 families at this point. So we're hoping to grow it, but it's completely self-funded. And since it was new for us, we really wanted to kind of figure out what worked and what didn't work and kind of where our strengths were. So it's been an eye-opener for my staff. Because it is so individualized, and you know, they were used to transitional housing, which again was, I don't want to say it's an easy method, but there's a pattern to kind of how you move people through that program. And with our rapid rehousing program, each case is different. And so there is no, I'm only giving you 3 months, or I'll give you 6 months, or I'm only giving you $1,500. It's really kind of determining what the need might be in that household.
I really like how you say that. I think we're finding that too at Friendship Shelter as we transition out of transitional housing, is from that predictable pattern to that sort of what's it going to take, and a negotiation with the client, with the landlord, with kind of the society about how we're going to help this unit, whether it's a family or an individual, get on their own feet.
The other thing we find is that it's hard for the clients in some instances too, because they want to know. Like they want to affirm, you're going to pay for 3 months, you're going to pay for 6 months, you're going to pay for 12 months. And I think that's just human nature for all of us, is we kind of want to know where our next meal's coming from, if you will. But it's allowing them the freedom and the independence to kind of figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of them having to share and communicate what their needs are, because that's part of helping them identify, you know, maybe how they got here or where they can go in the future.
And that helps reduce that stigma, right?
You bet.
To be able to, we can just talk about this. It's just a conversation. Right. These are your needs. There's no shame. There's no guilt. There's nothing. We don't have to have those associations with that. Let's just talk about what's going on.
What's going on, yeah. Really. And I think whether it's our food pantry, any of our programs, that is the biggest thing, is for people to understand that it's not our job to judge why you got here. We need to know how you got to the situation you're in, because without that, we can't really offer the appropriate services to help you.
All right. That's Laura Fisher. She's the executive director at South County Outreach. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'm a little miffed that we haven't done it sooner, but hopefully we'll do it again. Yes,
I hope so. Yes,
as long as you're
right down the street.
Yeah,
right.
As long as you're around, you might be one of our standby on call guests.
I love that.
You might get a call at 8 o'clock any morning, going, Laura, what are you doing this morning?
I'm up early. So.
All right, you were at the National Alliance to End Homelessness National Conference. Dawn was there. Mike Austin is in the wings. He was also at that conference. How about if we take a quick music break, and when we get back, I'd like to talk about your guys' experience at that conference. Good?
Good, yeah.
All right. You're listening to The Friendship Show here on KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Cakes 93.5, Laguna's only FM. This is The Friendship Show in the 8 o'clock hour, The Importance of Being Earnest with Ernest Hackman, taking the week off up north at a music festival. I'm here this morning. Dawn Price is here. She's a regular on the show, oftentimes a co-host. We were talking before with Laura Fisher, executive director of South County Outreach. She seems to have it all going on, doesn't she?
She absolutely does.
Well, you're so nice.
We have a great team down here in South County, and I don't think we bang our drum loudly enough. You know, South County Outreach, we had Margie Wakeham and from Families Forward here a few weeks ago. We really have some high-performing organizations.
Yes, we do. And, by the way, Mary Perdue from Families Ministry is going to be, I think, in 2 weeks.
That's
She's going to be on the show.
Yeah, great.
She's going to be on the show. All right, you just got back from the National Alliance to End Homelessness, National Conference on Homelessness. I know that this was sort of a big goal of yours, to get us out of Orange County and on a big stage to hear what's going on, not just in our backyard, but what's going on around the country, and try to grab that wave a little bit. Laura was there. Oh, Mike Austin has joined us. He's in the studio.
Good morning, Mark.
Say good morning. Get really close to that microphone.
Good morning, all.
Mike has a good radio.
I was just gonna say that he's got a serious radio voice.
Yeah.
But you got to really eat that microphone. It has to be right on you.
Hey, you're fine. You're doing great.
I have a cold.
Do you?
Yes.
So you don't normally have that radio voice.
Mike Austin was at that conference as well, representing Friendship Shelter. Why was it important to you?
You know, I came out of two organizations previously in my career in nonprofits that were local affiliates of national organizations. I worked for years at Planned Parenthood, and I also worked for years at Ronald McDonald House Charities. And the thing about working for an organization like that is there's a built-in group of colleagues nationally, mm-hmm. and there's an opportunity, a regular opportunity, both regionally and nationally, to learn from each other and to feel a part of the larger, in the case of really both of those organizations, the international community of people doing the same work that you're doing. And it's, for me, incredibly energizing to be in that setting. It's coming away with so many ideas. That the other thing I really learned is that it can be a great team building opportunity for your staff if you take more than one, if it's not just you. I worked in Ronald McDonald House, it was always only me. And I would come back all excited and nobody else would. They're like, all right, yeah. Fine.
Dawn's back from her vacation.
Right. So I didn't want our organization to take that leap until we could take the leap with not just one person going. And so three of us went this year. We let our board know immediately when we got back how transformational it was for us. And I think we can begin to build a culture where we send two or three people every year, and different people. The same people don't have to go every time. But to have that experience is really, really helpful. I found it very valuable.
Laura, how many people from South County aren't you?
I went by myself, but I can echo what she said in that I spent a lot of time in previous positions going to national conferences. I think they're important, especially when you're at a small agency. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was there was so much information. I found it exhausting. I was exhausted when I got home.
Every day.
Mainly because there was just so many different, there was just a ton of different information, and you were hearing from so many facets. Mm-hmm. And it was great to get out of Orange County and kind of hear what else was happening around the country.
Right. And I think the other thing that you just said, I think, is incredibly important for these national conferences to hear from us, these relatively small organization, $3 million organization, $2 million organization, to be there and make sure that voice is part of the conversation.
Is there an overall, outside of homelessness, was there a theme, some sort of guiding principle to this conference of we're here to achieve this or learn this or hear about this?
To me, the theme was ending homelessness. Mm-hmm. And it's moving, making the transition from managing homelessness, helping people deal with the fact that they're homeless or poor, to really ending homelessness and really moving the needle, taking the numbers and trying to dissect that data and figure out how we can really make a difference. And there are communities that are effectively ending homelessness in their communities. And
really?
That's really exciting to hear about.
Yeah, I think that where the difference, the hard part is Orange County is kind of its own animal. Mm-hmm. And I think where a lot of the communities are seeing great success with private and public dollars, it's very city focused. So when you think about, you know, Minneapolis, or you think about St. Louis, you think about Salt Lake City, mm-hmm. some of those areas, I think there's, I don't want to say it's easier because there's no place that homeless is easier, mm-hmm. but I think maybe geographically it adds to them being able to work better together. And there were some very creative ideas on how people are coming up with different programs, how they're spending money, how they're working together. It was very exciting.
I lived for 20 years in Minneapolis, and I was flipping through the conference brochure and presenters, mm-hmm. and I was so happy to see Minneapolis playing an important role in the national conference. And I know they've done great work in Minneapolis in ending homelessness, and I would just say being homeless in Minneapolis, that's a tough.
That's a scary thing.
Yeah.
It's cold.
Yeah, that's a tough spot to be homeless.
That'll move you toward shelter as a community a lot quicker than it happens here. Because
right.
I think people here say, well, sleep, yeah. Outside,
right, exactly. Exactly. Bad. Because in January in the Midwestern, you guys are both Midwest people. You know that. You can't be outside in January at night with no place to sleep.
Right.
That's not going to work at all.
No.
Well, and I think the other thing that cities have from a PR and visibility standpoint in generating interest into homelessness is most of them have some form of Skid Row. And I think we all know that we've got, you know, some people living in Santa Ana that are very visible. But really in South Orange County, a lot of our homeless are pretty invisible.
Right.
And Richard Gere was there and gave a great presentation, I thought. But the one thing that he talked about that really resonated with me was that homeless people aren't invisible. They're a black hole that the general population is afraid to be sucked into. And I thought that was really very striking because mm-hmm. it's not a matter of people not looking at homeless people. It's about you not wanting to look at homeless people. And that's understandable. I mean, nobody wants to necessarily see those types of challenges every day, but it's a reality.
I was struck by that, too. He talked about his experience as an actor, and he lives in New York. And he filmed this film where he played a homeless individual, a chronically homeless man, and they did this stealth filming process where they were filming from windows and things where people, he was on the street filming his movie during the day in New York, and the people walking around him didn't realize they were in a movie. And
didn't know that it was Richard Gere panhandling
so
on the
Richard
corner.
Richard Gere with very minimal makeup, with very minimal, like, it's not like they dirtied him up mm-hmm. and made him look unrecognizable. It's clearly Richard Gere, and you're watching these clips. But he talked about being able to be on the street in front of a Starbucks in New York City for 4 hours and not have a single person recognize him as Richard Gere. And we talked about the black hole. I was really struck by that, too.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up. As he talked about it, you know, it's not that I was invisible. It was that people were afraid to even engage. to even in that black hole analogy of just, you know, just needing to keep a distance from this thing, this, and it's not a person, it's this idea of homelessness, and just and it goes to people's feelings of guilt and people's feelings of helplessness as a society of, I know I can't, if I get there, I'm going to feel too bad. I'm going to, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to make a difference. I'm not going to be able to make a change. So I just want to just resist even going there. And I thought it was really insightful of him to see that. I think part of that's his Buddhist sort of worldview, right, that he wasn't judging these people. He was trying to understand why they weren't able to
engage with him. How the phenomenon occurs.
Yeah. It was really, really, that was really, really striking.
And I do think he gained a pretty good understanding because they allowed them to go into Bellevue. The gentleman that he's portraying, and I believe the movie's called Time Out of Mind.
Time Out of Mind.
Yeah, and it's due out in September. Mm-hmm. But they allowed him to go into Bellevue in New York and film. So, you know, he really wanted to understand mm-hmm. a lot of the reasons that people become homeless.
When you're at this conference and you're going around and listening to, you know, different presentations and learning things, how does Orange County compare? What were the similarities that you find between our community and what's going on around the country? And what were the striking differences to you?
One of the striking differences to me was exactly what Lara said earlier, is that we don't have the kind of coordinated and multifaceted effort that you see in the really high performing mm-hmm. Continuums or communities. They're called continuums because previously there's this continuum of care, and that's a HUD word. But the high performing places have a lot more than just HUD dollars, and not to say that we don't. California has the Mental Health Health Services Act, and that's a lot of additional dollars mm-hmm. coming in to Orange County. But there, without large cities, we don't have a lot of the federal money that flows through cities in Orange County, and so there's a little bit less of that, and not the private, frankly, effort that you see in a place like Utah, where there's a lot of private money going into mm-hmm. their, and they have ended chronic homelessness in
St. Louis too,
and St. Louis as well, right? With a lot of private money. So
when you say private money, what is that?
Corporate money.
Yeah, even individual money.
Individuals.
You know, and I think
Seattle has a lot of corporate money.
Yeah, as we talked, you know, really throughout the county, but really in South Orange County, you know, we work really well together, and I think we're proud of the achievements that the other agencies have. But I think what you see in those other areas is we're willing to collaborate with one another, but there's real no coordination because the agencies themselves are very busy. And so the effort is there, but it doesn't always come to a fruition, if you will. And I think in some of these other areas, whether it's the continuum or the county or some type of overhead spearheading organization, they will coordinate the logistics and the tactical components that get those collaborations maybe moving forward.
Yeah. Why do you think that is in wherever it was, Utah or St. Louis, when you say there's a lot more private money, particularly corporate money, is foundation money, mm-hmm. is that part of it?
Right.
Why do you think that is? Why is it easier for them to have that infusion of resource and maybe not so much here?
Well, again, I think our political power is very diffused in Orange County. We don't have a single mm-hmm. mayor. We don't have a single, you know, you think of New York City and Bill de Blasio, and you've got this person who's got the attention of the corporate community and can pull that together. And in a place like Orange County with no real central city, that single person, I mean, Utah also appointed this sort of homelessness czar, and he was already connected in the corporate community and able to build that will. And it's not just money, it's will.
It is.
It's
influence.
It's influence. It's having those corporations walking alongside you and making this change. And that's the other big theme from the conference that I walked away with, is that if we're feeling in Orange County like things are shifting under our feet very quickly, that is not an unusual response mm-hmm. that's happening nationally. People are reeling from this change from the transitional housing model to rapid rehousing mm-hmm. and permanent supportive housing. And it is a big shift. An analogy that I wrote down that I think is really apt for where we are in homeless services nationally is the analogy of having a new smartphone. And the new smartphone, you know it's good, it looks good, you can get real excited about it, so you've got that in your hand now. But shifting all your data to the new smartphone and learning how it works and all the apps changing and your contacts aren't where you thought they were and things like that, that's hard. And we're kind of in that stage as a county and really as a system nationally right now, where we know what the new tool is, but we don't know how it works yet. And some of it's not working the way we expected. And that's very frustrating. And we can get really angry because it's not the way it used to be. And I used to know how to do this and now I don't. And it's having the ability to take a breath and realize it's going to be okay and fix things that aren't working well and go to tech support. And you can take that analogy on and on and on. But I think it's really helpful to think about it that way, because we do have this new thing, this new way of looking at homelessness and this new way of responding. Not everything is working perfectly. We were at a couple of meetings 2 days ago on coordinated entry, and it's a great idea, and I think our county's going to get there. And that, just briefly for listeners, is the notion that a single door where all homeless people would go through and then get sorted out to the appropriate intervention for them. We're just at the baby steps of that. It's a new tool, and there are some things that we're learning are really not working very well. That's okay. We'll get there. It doesn't mean you throw the phone away. And that, so I felt that was a really helpful.
I think the other thing that concerns a lot of folks is outcomes versus outputs. And for so long, it was all about, well, have you taken them off the street, or have they stayed housed, whatever. And that's still part of the model. And I think, when people are talking about funding, whether it's a private funder or a public funder, you want to be able to say, these were the successes I had, where really we should be talking about, these are the failures I had, because you're going to learn more from them. Mm-hmm. But that's a hard thing to talk to people about. You know, nobody wants to say, my program, I only had success in 50% of the people I helped. But what we need to do is say, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? Let's fix that.
Because here's what we learned, and now we know what is going to be effective.
But that's a hard thing, to be able to talk, especially when you have multiple funders. And I think in some of those cities, when you look at a St. Louis, really Anheuser-Busch is still kind of the leader in that community. I think in some of those instances, the influence and the money is coming from somebody that's probably very influential in a lot of arenas. Mm-hmm. And so when they put their clout behind ending homelessness, people stand up and listen to it. Yeah. There are so many big corporations, so many foundations in Orange County, that there's really not one.
There's not that one.
Right. That people look to and say, okay, so-and-so is doing it, so we're all going to follow, because that's where the success is going to come.
Right. And I really kind of understand that. And that sort of makes sense to me, where, we're kind of concerned about our individual communities, our individual boroughs, and not, the county as a whole, as one, sort of big community. And so, I want homelessness solved in Santa Ana. I don't, what happens in Costa Mesa doesn't really concern me that much.
Right.
And there's no one single person who's saying, we represent Orange County, this is the problem that we're tackling. Mm-hmm. It's not about individual communities. It's about the greater whole.
And I think with the coordinated entry, the kind of analogy I use with coordinated entry is that for most people, it's like a hotel reservation system. Mm-hmm. And instead of you having to call 14 hotels at, Virginia Beach to determine where you can get a room for the night, you call Hilton and you say, I need
go to Travelocity.
Right. I need a queen size bed, and I'd like an ocean view, and I'm going to be there for 2 days. And really, that's what coordinated entry is for our homeless population. Now they're having to call, Dawn or me or Margie or any number
or
of places.
Of
yeah. And you're hearing different things, and each of us have different forms to fill out. And it's like going to the DMV every hour on the hour. But you're homeless. Right. It's got to be gut-wrenching. Mm-hmm. Where this way, they're going to call one location, and they're going to know immediately what's available to them.
Mm-hmm. Mike Austin, what was your big takeaway from going to a national conference? From your perspective, you're the director of finance. What do you...
Well, I took my green eye shades with me just as a security blanket, but... It was impossible to go there and keep them on, because what I found out was that, and as these guys mentioned, so many dimensions to homelessness were addressed at this. It was mind-boggling that, we have a huge challenge nationally and locally to kind of get on board with this new philosophy of housing homeless people who are undergoing, as one homeless person, previously homeless person, an advocate in the crowd said, we're not homeless, we're just in the midst of a housing crisis, which I thought was a very striking way to talk about the problem. You know, as we house more and more individuals, and just by the way that this coordinated entry system has been set up, the people that are going to be getting housed are going to be the most vulnerable people that we've evaluated and said these people really, really need to get off the street because harm could come to them if they don't get housed. And you know, that's one of the things that I found striking, because the implications of doing that, it's just, we're not just going to give them a front door. You know, the day after they're housed, they're still going to have a lot of needs. And you know, at Friendship Shelter and all of the other organizations in Orange County that are addressing this issue, that's, it's a big challenge, because those kind of support services are expensive, and newly housed individuals are spread out all over the place. So getting to them now that they have a home, and making sure that they're able to make it now that they're housed is going to be a big challenge.
I think when you talk about the different dimensions that they were of homelessness that they were discussing at the national conference, it kind of goes back to what you were saying. I think that this is something that we're learning, and it's the difference between managing and ending homelessness. Mm-hmm. For all of the, you know, we all have computer, you know, centers, and we all have, you know, employment, you know, training and all of those sorts of things. And for the people that works for, that's great. The lightest touch possible, right? Mm-hmm. What's the least you need from me so that you can go on with your life? But there is this group of people who are not going to respond to that intervention. And something needs to be done about that. And it's not about tricking the system, right? It's like, yeah. Sometimes I think we're so afraid someone's going to get a sandwich they didn't earn.
Exactly.
That we don't want to help.
Right. And I think the other really helpful, and you, it almost sounds slogan-y, but for me it's really helpful to think about these things like moving the dial and the iPhone analogy. The other one that really struck me was that we're moving from fixing the people to fixing the problem. So it doesn't matter if that person wants to accept being fixed, because we don't have to fix them. We have to fix their problem. We have to help them not be homeless anymore. And if we can do that, and in the process of that, gain their trust, gain their ability to look at themselves in new ways, they may themselves begin to fix some things about themselves. But we stop judging, we stop fixing them, and we start looking at what's
right.
The problem.
Because this problem affects us, right?
Right, because this problem isn't just their problem.
Right.
This problem is my problem if they're homeless in my neighborhood. This problem is my problem if they're homeless in front of my business. And so that becomes our problem rather than their problem. And then we're fixing our problem, our society's problem with homelessness. And in the process, a lot of people start fixing themselves too. But it stopped, we take that burden off ourselves. We don't have to fix the person. We just have to fix the
right.
problem.
The term ready for home.
Right.
Ready. I'm ready to be housed now.
Yeah.
Everybody's ready to be housed. They may not be ready to maintain their housing mm-hmm. once they're in housing, but everybody's ready not to be living on the street.
Right.
Right. And this notion that we hear often from people, good people, who want to understand the problem, that really believe that there are people that just want to be homeless. And aren't there people that just want to be homeless? And, you know, yeah, maybe. But I think they want to be free more than they want to be homeless.
Be homeless, right.
And if we can help them be free in a home, they're going to be happy with that too.
Right. And that's what you say. People are ready to be housed. The problem is all of the barriers that go with it, right?
Right.
And so I'm happy to house you. Here's, you know, here's the 50 things I need you to do so that I can feel good about it. And, you know, 48 of those things you're impossible of. So I guess you're not ready to be housed. And we have to change the way that we look at that.
Absolutely.
All right. Best speaker that you heard? Was there anyone that you heard at the conference that you just thought, wow, guy's got it going on?
I got really excited about the director of libraries in Salt Lake City. He has a 3-person homeless outreach team that works out of his first of all, it's a phenomenal library. Google the Salt Lake City Public Library. It's an amazing building. Many libraries have a lot of homeless people in them. It's a safe place to be during the day. There's air conditioning. There's internet. lots of reasons why a homeless person would hang out at a library, but he has embraced that as part of his mission as a librarian. And a librarian, in his philosophy, is he says we're taught that part of our job is to make this information available to anyone. And he says,
wow,
anyone
awesome.
Means anyone. And so he opens his library to homeless people. He has services in the library, actively involved in helping people be housed. And no surprise that that's in Salt Lake City, in Utah, where there's such a coordinated effort toward understanding chronic homelessness and ending chronic homelessness. He's really leaning into that problem and a big part of their solution. So he was a really exciting guy.
I think that's a great role for libraries, right? In this digitized age where I think libraries struggle.
Right.
But this is like a place where real human contact still actually happens.
Exactly.
Right?
And his understanding and belief that homeless people aren't at a library just to get warm or just to be under a roof. There's a reason they're drawn to a library for information, and isn't that
mental
exciting?
Stimulation.
And isn't that exciting that someone that we would that feels like a black hole on the street wants to be in front of a screen or reading a book or reading a magazine, and that's a point at which we can begin to see a similarity between us and that person. So it's really, really exciting.
And I would say, you know, like the tone is really good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Everyone's calm.
Right, exactly.
Everyone's, you know, respectful and all those sorts of things. It's a nice tone to engage people in.
But he was also a good speaker because he was very practical. He shared emails he got from people in the community giving helpful suggestions. And, you know, maybe we could have a homeless section of the library and so that they could all be in some section. And, you know, things that we hear all the time as providers. And so it wasn't just this glossy, you know, there's a thing when people come and present at a conference, they just want to make it seem like they've solved it all. And he didn't have that either. So I really enjoyed him. And I don't have his, you have my thing, so I don't have his name, but he was a good guy.
Yeah. He was in Utah?
Salt Lake City, Utah.
Salt Lake City, Utah.
He's the head of the library there.
Laura, what did you seek out?
You know, I would say similarly, and I can't remember her name, there was a woman represented Alameda County. And she gave some really good presentations, too, because they were doing some creative things, whether it was bridge housing or interim housing and housing first, and they're working them all together. And I think so many times, because we're all receiving some form of public money, we get tied up in what we call things, and we need to move away from that. It really doesn't matter if we call it transitional housing or we call it rapid rehousing or whatever, the house, bridge housing, interim housing. We really need to focus on housing. And they were doing some pretty cool things where they were collaborating and bringing all those different programs together to just meet people's needs.
You hear a lot about Alameda County.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That they're doing a lot of stuff up there. Mike, where were you?
Well, I attended one of the, I think, takeaways from the whole 4 days was that there's not going to be sufficient government funding to get the job done. Mm-hmm. And that partnerships to help supplement the funding that we need are absolutely critical. One session that I attended, there was a woman from back east who helped basically syndicate all the funders in, I think, Connecticut, and form a process by which local organizations throughout the state were able to access those funds. That, you know, that worked well. It's a small state. It's not like, you know, California. But one of the other guys on the panel was from right here in San Diego. A private individual owns a coin shop down in San Diego, and he took it upon himself to understand the homelessness situation in San Diego, get involved with the provider community, and help create a process by which individuals, other businesses could help fund those organizations. And it was impressive that one individual with, you know, some financial might got involved and took it upon himself and is now teaching others how to be part of the donor community.
I think it's okay for government to say, we'll get the ball rolling here. And we'll get this started, but we're not going to do this all for you. You're going to have to get people engaged in your communities. And I think it is that kind of guy who's saying, there's a problem on my block, and I want to get it taken care of. So what can I do? What do I need to do to take some responsibility here?
Yeah, that message over and over, I think, at this conference is just that you know, it's everyone's problem, and again, fix the problem, not the people.
All right. As always happens here on the Friendship Show, we run out of
time. Flew by.
Yeah, we run out of time before we run out of things to talk about. Laura, so nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite.
We'll do it again, yes?
Yes.
All right. Dawn Price, you're headed off to New York City.
I'm going to stay with Caleb here. I want to hear from Caleb.
Oh, you are? Oh, you're going to stay for the second hour?
I am going to stay for the second hour.
Oh, wow. Wow. What a treat. Mike Austin, thanks for stopping in this morning.
Anytime, Mark.
Really?
Mike doesn't have to move his car to come here. He lives about a block away.
So. I was going to say, anytime, and that's recorded, you know, so I can pull that up.
I almost missed the turn this morning.
All right. It was great to have you guys here. Coming up, Caleb Scott was here a couple of weeks ago. He's been out traveling around the world, changing things. We ran out of time, and we didn't get to, like, the most important part of what he was doing, so... Caleb Scott is going to be back for the second hour of our two-hour double header. So we're going to take a quick music break. And when we get back, it's going to be more Friendship Show here on KX 93.5, Laguna's only FM.
Thank you for tuning in to The Friendship Show. Join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. for a full hour of real issues, stimulating discussion, and the chance to visit with old and new friends right here on KX 93.5, Laguna's only FM.